Hi, I'm Niko Kisilov, and this is our third lecture in the Effective Model-Based Testing with Spec Explorer series. I'll be talking today about testing with abstract state machines as opposed to finite state machines, which is what we did last class. When we use abstract state machines, the approach is very similar to the one we saw already. We still write a set of guarded at date rules to explain how the model starts from one state and moves on through these rules to other states. And that's pretty much what there is to it. The difference lies in the fact that now state of an abstract state machine can be much richer than the one of a finite state machine. So in state variables, we can have basic types like bool, for example, which we used last time, also int, just by, as we discussed last time, right? Just by having a variable of type integer, one is opening up the state space much more. And then we could have collection types, such as lists, or lists represent sequences, maps that represent dictionaries or sets. And that, of course, makes the potential state space much larger. Because now we can have, let's say I just have one collection, one list in my model program as part of the state, then that means I could potentially again have one state with the empty with the collection being empty, and then one state with the collection having one element, another state with the collection having two elements, and so on. And that's considering a single element value. Then I can combine element values, and I can have obviously infinite states. That again would depend on the rules taking me to all the states for the machine to actually be infinite. And collections are just one example of an object graph. So I can create types, classes that have several fields, and those fields are classes again, and that determines a whole object model that will represent each state. So each possible state will correspond to a different object graph with different values in all the nodes. That makes then machine abstract rather than finite. Why do we need to do this? And that's a question people often ask. The fact is that the systems that we'll be modeling most of the time have a very rich state. So for example, the system that we might be testing could have a database in the background. So that determines different states of the system for every possible state of the database. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that we need our model to have a representation of the full system state. In fact, that is not the case most of the time. So why do we want to have a complex state in the model too? And the answer is that in order to predict future behavior of the model, part of that state, of the inferred state of the application that will be tested, needs to be known. For example, going back to the example of the database, if one of my actions results in a query of the database, the result that I would expect in a test case would depend on the contents of the database at that point. So there's no way for the model to predict what the result should be if it doesn't have some representation of the current state of the implementation. And given that the current state can be fairly complex, we also need to support complex states in our model. Or we would be abstracting out too much, right? Because we could say, okay, let's not try to test whether the result of the query is correct. Let's just count the number of records returned by a query. Yes, We could do that, and then a simple number for the expected number of the expected result count would do. But the problem is that doesn't make the system correct, because if we are interested in testing the actual values that we get back, then we're abstracting too much. We're abstracting out the tests that we would like to make. So that's why we will work today with abstract state machines. And the example I will use is the at service. I'll talk a little bit about the at service now. I have a question. Yes?
One question on the previous slide. So it seems like you're contrasting abstract and finite as opposed to finite and infinite.
Right.
And it wasn't the simple stopwatch state machine also an abstract state machine by the rules you gave here?
Right. I'll repeat the question. So the question is, it looks like we're talking about two types of machines, and we call them finite and abstract versus instead of finite and infinite. And actually, our finite state machines can also be considered abstract state machines. And that is true. Actually, as I've shown here, given a set of guarded update rules, we build a machine, and that's how you build an abstract state machine, right? The difference is that if instead of giving a set of guarded rules, or if one would forget or be oblivious about the way in which the machine is specified and would look at the result, the result of a finite state machine, of an abstract state machine whose state is finite, let's say, is what is called in the literature, and the formalism is very well known, a finite state machine, where all that matters is some arbitrary identifier for each state, and that determines the whole machine, right? So what we're doing is, yes, it's true that we're not changing the formalism we use to model, but we're stepping up inside, let's say, the realm of the abstract state machines and going from just the finite state machines, which can be seen as a subset of the abstract state machines, to the full power of abstract state machines. So that's a good question. Okay, so the at service, this is what we will be testing is a command, a command that one can type in a command prompt in Windows called at.exe. And what it does is it schedules jobs to be executed on a machine at a certain time. It can be used to schedule the jobs, to delete jobs that were scheduled, and to query the machine about the jobs that it's queued to execute. Other operations will be abstracted out here. And on the other hand, this is very important about what we're trying to test. The command is just about scheduling jobs. So if we're testing if the command works or not, it doesn't make sense to check whether the jobs do what they are supposed to do, because that's not part of what the command is supposed to control. It's just about scheduling, deleting, and querying. That's the at service then, and I'll use this all through our presentation today. I'll use this workflow that shows one of the ways, at least, in which one can develop a model and test from it. So model-based testing, MBT workflow. Starting from requirements, we can design the model in several steps, and at the same time, potentially, in parallel, someone will implement, that's create an application based on those requirements. There will be perhaps an adapter that will be created to connect the generated tests to the implementation. And this adapter, together with the generated tests, will be used to run the tests and analyze the logs. The first step, then, is to gather requirements. And I'll give you an example of two requirements for the at service. One is, this is R1 and R2 and identifiers, just names that arbitrary names that we assign to these requirements. The first one says when I'm adding a job, the server must return a unique job identifier, right? Where unique means a job identifier that hasn't been used before, at least in this run. And requirement number two says when querying information about a job, the server obviously needs to return the same information that was provided at scheduling time. I have a question here.
And actually, to be referred to the previous diagram.
Yes.
So if there's a case where you can't, there's a system under test, is the implementation, and I can understand that. But let's say you cannot directly invoke that. You have a test abstraction or a test framework, testing any way applications, so you want to go through that. So how will that fit in the picture, actually, here?
The question is, what if we cannot connect directly the generated tests to the system under test? And that's what the adapter does. This is one of the cases. I'll even show it in the example today. The fact is that we're testing a server implementation that's not managed code. It's not .NET. So we need to do something about it. And we need to test it somehow, right? It's part of the Windows operating system. So what I'll be using today to test it is the at command. So this is a command line application. And I somehow get my adapter to invoke this command line application, right? Yes. Back here.
I was just thinking about what you said about it's even possible to have one person working on the adapter and implementation and one person working on the model. It seems to me, though, that the interface, that the model has to be at least a subset of the adapter, right? And that interface has to be the same. So you can't, I don't think it's possible to blindly have somebody say, okay, you go ahead and design an adapter, or something over here, and I'll work on this, without having some collaboration where you agree on the interface of how you're going to talk to your system under test.
Right. For the benefit of the people watching on video, the question is about basically synchronization points. Let's say there are different teams working on model design and the part on the right, the implementation, adapter, and so on. And that's what the yellow arrows are about. So there are some points at which both teams need to synchronize somehow. In fact, supposedly at least, the people working on the implementation, who actually don't need to be the same, were working on the adapter. So this can be a testing team, whereas the adapter designers, because this, the purpose of the adapter is just to test the implementation, and this could be a development team creating the application that will be tested. So perhaps the adapter is grouped together with the model design, or it's even partitioned among different people on the same team. That is a resource assignment problem, if you want. But still, both the implementation and the model will be built from a single set of requirements, right? Then we, let's say methodologically, just for methodological purity, let's say, we want teams working separately, not the same people writing the model and the implementation, and that this is testing 101, if you want. You don't want the same people creating the application and testing it end-to-end at least, because you want someone who comes from the outside somehow and might have a different interpretation of the requirements, right? But they do need to synchronize at least on the requirements. And then when you're creating the adapter, which could be at the end of the implementation development when you want to actually test, so the time at which the adapter is created is not fixed, but they do need to synchronize with the model designer to make sure that they share a set of actions. And we'll see that today. Those are the yellow arrows. Yeah. So, yes, I have another question.
Just one more quick question. This may sound silly, but is there sort of a formal guidance on how the scope of what requirements should be? There could be lots of requirements in some
ways. Right.
Any simple requirements, maybe some requirements complex. There's some sort of guidance on how to make requirements that work in the context of these started update rules to
Right. First, it's not a silly question, but the question is whether there's any. There are only silly answers, right? Not silly questions. But the question is whether there is any way to any guidance as to what requirements should look like. And basically, I would say it's about granularity, right? How finely granular should the requirements be, or how coarse they can be, right? And actually, the answer is no, or at least the answer is Spec Explorer is oblivious to that detail. So basically, whatever you want your requirements to be, you can use them then with Spec Explorer, and there are several books, and there's enough literature about requirements and different approaches, but Spec Explorer doesn't have any requirement as to what the requirements should be, right? So let me move on with the workflow. So we'll talk about, and this is related to David's question, identifying the actions and designing the adapter, which are synchronized tasks. So let's recall the test architecture. In the presence of a test adapter, we need to have core declarations that refer to the adapter actions. So this is basically the yellow arrow that I was showing before. There has to be a relationship between the action declarations in a core script for Spec Explorer and the actions present in the adapter. The model then will be based on the actions in the core script. Once it produces test cases, the test cases will run against the adapter because of the reference established at this point. And the adapter is the one that will control and observe the implementation. So let's get to it. I have a sample here. Any questions? No. Okay. So this is a solution for the ad service. And this, again, is an example, one of the samples included in the Spec Explorer distribution. So by installing Spec Explorer, you get at least one version, which is the one I'm showing here today, of the ad service. So I'll go to the adapter, actually, because this has already been created, and open up this C# file. The adapter basically defines two things. One is the job info structure that it will use to interchange, to exchange data with the tests. And the job info only has the a string representing the command that has to be executed when the job actually is run and the time at which the job should run. The other thing is just a way to show the command and the time in a single string. And that's the structure that will be used to communicate basically between the job information between test case and the adapter. The other thing is a class actually implementing the adapter, and it has all the details that one needs here, like a process and a list of free IDs. We'll talk a little bit about that. But as you can see here, whenever it gets first, when it's initialized, it sets up the process and associates the command line that will be called. And then when a job needs to be added, it really invokes that process and sends the information to the server for it to be scheduled. So this is basically the adapter, and that's when during the adapter design, the actions were defined. This add service members, like add job, delete job, and delete all jobs, get job info, execute command, and so on. Well, execute command shouldn't be one of the add service members because this is more internal. But at least these are the actions that we want to test. They were all declared as public. The other thing we did is in the config code file, now in the model project, we needed to declare actions corresponding to these methods that will be tested. Instead of declaring them one by one, we used the syntax action all. And what this does is it tells Spec Explorer to consider every method in this type. In this case, this is a type, the add service type that I was showing before, add service. Every method in that type will be considered an action, every method or event. Just one second. The other thing I wanted to point out is that in order to do this, of course, I need to resolve this name to an actual type name, a fully qualified type name. That's why I have some using statements in court. In this case, I'm using the adapter. And also, the model project needs a reference to the adapter project. So from both the reference here and the using clause in court, I can get a reference to the actual type. Yes?
In your at services.cs, the execute was not public. So when you do action all, does it only get the public ones, or does it get both public and private?
Good question. So some of the methods here, some of the members of this class at service are not public. For example, the execute command. And the question is, does this get imported as an action into court when I say action all? The answer is yes. If I only want public members, I would say here action all public. And this would import only public methods. If I import non-public methods, I will probably have a problem at testing time. So, because the test will try to invoke these methods, and most probably the test will not be allowed to invoke them if they are not public. Depends on the classes and so on, on the assemblies and so on. But we are thinking that probably in the future we might invoke non-public methods by reflection from a test case so that we can still test non-public methods. But the current version will not be able to invoke them. Yes?
Plus, we can have as many classes as we want, right? We can have another.
You can say action all
another
type 1, action all type 2, and you get all those as actions.
And we can also choose not to implement some of the actions. Like, we want this only in a few actions.
That's a different question. So the question is, can we first, can we import as many types, actions from as many types as we want? The answer is yes, you can do that. The other question is, should we implement them all the classes, that all the actions that we have imported? And the answer to that is, first, there's no implementing of actions. The only thing you do is you create rules to explain Spec Explorer, when it's exploring a model, whether that action should create a step. So no, you don't need to have rules for all of them. If you don't have rules, you can still have, for example, a scenario, as I did in yesterday's class with the initialize action. You can still have that action inserted into a behavior without having rules for them, right? Still, there are some operators in court that will create, for example, if I use the dot, dot, dot operator somewhere, and let me show, here's a scenario. If at some point I say dot, 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 this means all possible actions in my configuration. So if you don't want a method to be really an action, you shouldn't import it. In this case, if I don't want this method here called execute command to be an action, I should exclude it. So I'll do that, actually. See how this works. So I'm saying action all at service, but action exclude this thing here. Right? So if this was before an action, it's no longer an action. Right?
How are we tying that and the ad service?
The question is, the question was how will it relate execute command to the ad service? It will not, of course, because this is missing the class prefix, right? Every action declaration needs a class name, even if it's abstract. So declaring an action as abstract means it has not yet been implemented, neither in an adapter or in an implementation, but I still want to explore it, so don't try to resolve this action to an actual method. But even so, I need to provide a class name. In the case of abstract actions, it's an arbitrary class name. Okay, let's go back to the deck then. And, yes?
Is it possible to have a rule that does not have a corresponding action?
The question is, can I have a rule that doesn't map to an action? No, you can't. If you have a rule that doesn't map to an action, it would result in an error.
So I can have an empty action which does nothing in the adapter.
The question is, can I have an empty action that does nothing in the adapter? The answer is yes. And sometimes you do that. At least you have to declare it so that it's called, but the adapter will do nothing about it. Yep.
So if you have all your actions, or if you call the actions in from ad service and you don't have rules for some of them, and you do dot, dot, dot in config, when it's exploring through the model, does it actually pick those actions and use them in every state?
That's a good question because I wasn't clear before. So the question is, let me go back here. And we'll see this a little bit more in detail, but let me show how this works. So the question is, let's say I add dot, dot, dot at the end or at any point of this scenario, and I don't have a rule for that other action, the do command action. Will it show up? Well, the answer is it depends on what I'm exploring, because as you can see, this machine here, machine add to jobs pattern, never constructs a model program. This is just a pure scenario. So this machine will look exactly as the scenario I defined here. It will have a job. It doesn't matter what the model says. There will be no parameters to the actions. There will be nothing in the states as contents of the states, just these steps as I have specified them. What I'm doing in the next machine, model program with two jobs patterns, is I'm combining the model program, which has been constructed in another machine, with this scenario. And this is what we call slicing. As I said, I'll be talking more about this. And basically, it restricts, it's sort of the intersection of two behaviors. So given that this behavior here, the add to jobs pattern, does have this action, but the other one, model program, doesn't have it, then it will not end up being in the final behavior, in the composition of both. So by adding dot, dot, dot here, I don't get to insert do command in the model program. But if I would add it here, for example, I would say, well, after doing this, go ahead and do whatever you want, then I would have it there. Right? So it depends on where I'm adding this to a behavior, basically. I had another question, sir. Okay. So let's go back to the presentation. And this was obviously, in a nutshell, identifying actions and designing an adapter, which need to be somehow in sync.